everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's episode is brought to you by Solera Networks, makers of fine big data security software and appliances. Do go check them out at soleranetworks.com. Although they have just been acquired by Bluecoat, so I don't know, maybe you go to bluecoat.com these days. In this week's show, we chat with author and speaker Richard Thieme about what they used to call the generation gap. NSA leaker Edward Snowden is a part of the internet generation. Are the ideals that he espouses rooted in countercultural ideals, or are they just generational norms for people of his vintage? And now that we have so many Gen Ys and millennials actually running the information infrastructure that powers our institutions, could we be on the cusp of serious changes in the way the establishment actually works? That is a fascinating chat, and it's coming up a bit later. In this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with John Vecchi, Solera's VP of Product Strategy, all about whether or not we are neglecting mundane threats these days because we're so focused on identifying APT. That is coming up later as well. But before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, I figure we should actually, for the next couple of months, we might want to change the name of the news segment to This Week in Prism.
Yeah, it's just the story just keeps on rolling and there's, you know, new bits of intrigue coming out. There's lots of new commentary.
Lots of intrigue and commentary, but not much new information.
Well, yeah, I was about to say, like, it's turning into one of those, you know, like everyone's got an opinion, like they have an asshole, but... Yeah, it's certainly been the talk across mainstream media and all the technical press.
Well, when we spoke about it last week, I think the thing that jumped out for you and me both was, hang on, this is a $20 million program and everyone's denying it. And probably not what is being reported. So I guess, in the last week, I've actually become fuzzier on what the hell this thing could be than I was previously.
Yeah, it's certainly much, much less clear than it was. And the fact that the Guardian just keeps kind of drip feeding us little bits of information when they have a bunch more, it really isn't helping. The price tag does suggest that it's not what was originally reported. And we've seen a bunch of other commentary come out which suggests that the Prism itself is some kind of interface for, automating the production and delivery of warrants to organizations like Google and Facebook, and then they have streamlined the process to return that data back into the data collection system at NSA, and then they can mine it, which that seems like something perhaps you could do for $20 million, although
you'd have a team of guys who might work on standardizing the Prism format and whatnot. I mean, if you read the article, it's in the show notes, it's the first article in the show notes, CNET has an FAQ basically on Prism, and it looks kind of like an internal Multigo for slicing and dicing data that's actually been collected from these companies, which seems a more plausible sort of idea, doesn't it, for that program?
Well, yeah, it does. And hopefully, we will see some more information. We can start to get a better understanding. Although, all this kind of nitpicking about exactly what it is and isn't, I suppose to a certain extent misses the point. I mean, in the end, the NSA can read my Gmail when it wants to, with appropriate US warrants. And I don't know if I like that, whether or not it's within their, legal obligation, legal rights to do so.
I don't think they need a FISA warrant to read your email because you're,
I'm a foreigner.
Because you're not in the US, right? I mean, I don't think they actually need a warrant. And that's the thing too, is like, I think Prism has become a little bit of a distraction because initially it was reported as this wholesale, oh my God, they've got complete backdoor access into all of these social networking providers, which they don't. I mean, honestly, it would be a pretty cohesive and awesome cover-up to get everyone denying it and everyone on the same page just saying, no, that's not what's happening. I mean, I believe the denials.
Yeah, I think that, that probably is the case. I mean, I've talked to a few people who work internally at some of these companies, and everyone is saying basically the same thing, which is we have no idea what the fuck they're on about, which, it does seem credible.
Yeah, now, meanwhile, since we spoke last, the bloke who leaked this information has surfaced in Hong Kong saying all sorts of stuff. We've got a story from Wired here where he's actually come out and said, yes, the NSA has been hacking Chinese targets since 2009, which makes me think, Eric Snowden, really, 2009? You probably might want to revise that backwards a little bit.
Yeah, a little late to the party there, Guy. But no, it's certainly, you know, his choice of Hong Kong as a place to go and the potential options for, you know, interaction between the Chinese and US governments over this and the way that it's playing into sort of the bigger, you know, discussion of hacking between China and the US in both directions. You know, it certainly has the potential to become a lot more political, you know, internationally than, you know, it is already. I mean, we're seeing, you know, some of the European states concerned about privacy already talking about this. But yeah, adding Chinese hacking, and especially if they've got evidence, and especially if they're going to, if we see, you know, Greenwald actually dropping some of the evidence that Snowden has pulled out, then, you know, things have the potential to get very, very interesting here.
Well, it's interesting too, because Kevin Paulson has actually written a story for Wired saying, you know, headline is, what's in the rest of the top secret NSA PowerPoint deck? I mean, what is in that slide deck? And pointed out that Glenn Greenwald was, you know, was throwing absolute mad fits when Paulson withheld the Manning Lamo chat logs, you know, and you know, Greenwald was like, what's he got to hide and all this sort of stuff. So Paulson's written a bit of a story like that that subtly points out that Greenwald's being a bit of a hypocrite here. And also, you know, has some quotes from Julian Assange, basically calling the Washington Post and the Guardian pussies for not publishing the slide deck. And I got to say, I'm kind of on Assange's side for this one. If we needed, you know, if WikiLeaks needed something to validate, you know, its existence, to actually give us a reason why we need something like WikiLeaks, this is actually it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I mean, I would love to see that full slide deck, as would, you know, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast. Mm. And yeah, and Paulson calling Greenwald on it is, you know, relatively poetic. And I think, you know, it's kind of funny to compare the three, you know, different styles of leaks that we've seen here, you know, the sort of the Manning WikiLeaks style, the Snowden style, and the third one, which of course is the, you know, sort of the Lulzsec Anonymous style. And they're all scratching, I thought they're all, you know, basically scratching the same itch, right? Which is that there's something kind of creepy going on here. Maybe Lulzsec more in it for the lulz, and, you know, Snowden mm-hmm. has some more morals. But yeah, it does suggest that there's something going on here that, you know, really does need to be brought into the public's attention. And, you know, from our point of view as technologists, the WikiLeaks approach gives us the best data.
Well, I mean, currently we're relying on the interpretation of the Washington Post and the Guardian, you know, after it's been to their lawyers and they've worked out what they can and can't publish. I mean, it's kind of not good enough, is it, really?
Well, no, I think the initial story, maybe they, you know, had some obligation to redact a bit, but it's just become so big that, you know, I think we deserve to know. And, you know, clearly that's what Snowden wanted to deliver to us. Mm. So, you know, let's see it.
Yeah. What do you think of this Snowden guy as well? Because to me, he strikes me, his rhetoric is very similar to that sort of, you know, and we've got an interview about this coming up a little bit later, but it's very much that Gen Y millennial sort of, you know, online privacy, deep suspicion of authority. He sounds like a Reddit post when he speaks, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does a bit. And I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you know, if you've been inside the machine and you've seen what it's doing and it outrages you, then you're our sort of people, you know, whether or not we're, you know, Gen X or Gen Y or, you know, just generically old bastards, curmudgeons perhaps. You know, and he seems like a reasonable sort of guy to me in the interview, but I'm sure there's plenty of other people who think otherwise.
Yeah, well, Hong Kong seems like a weird choice, and some of his rhetoric, you know, calling himself a spy, stuff like that, just seems a little weird. I mean, I guess we'll see how it plays out, but the guy seems just a little bit off to me, right? And I'm sure we'll find out a little bit more about him in due course. Now, meanwhile, I mean, one thing he's been very successful at is throwing the cat among the pigeons, even if we don't entirely know what PRISM is. I mean, there's been a lot of political fallout from this. We've got a bunch of lawmakers in the United States seeking to declassify a lot of, the FISA court. What is it? The FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. They want to declassify a lot of the operation of that court, which I think is fair enough. Meanwhile, we've got Google calling for greater transparency so that they can actually come out and dispel some of the myths around PRISM. And probably more interestingly, we've got the ACLU suing the NSA over the Verizon stuff. And I think, you know, PRISM has been a real distraction from the really scary stuff, which is the access to metadata that the NSA wanted. I mean, they've gone out to all of the phone companies and pulled in domestic call records. It's even caused political fallout here when it's been revealed that, you know, the Australian Federal Police and State Police and whatever have put in 50,000 or whatever, you know, warrantless metadata requests. It's really put the issue on the agenda, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing similar discussions in Parliament over here in New Zealand. We had a member of Parliament refuse to hand over his emails to a journalist, where apparently he's alleged to have leaked some documents to the press. And he's previously been kind of voting for our revised interception and security laws, and now he doesn't want to hand over his email. So it's this issue is playing up all around the world, and especially in the West, where we like to think that we're free, and in fact it turns out that we're being surveilled all up and down the place.
I guess another thing I find interesting too is that, everyone's talking about PRISM. And I think in the broader sense, like as far as mainstream debate and political fallout goes, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you and I can sit here and go, well, it's a $20 million program. It's not doing what is being alleged. Okay, but then you look at the new data center the NSA is building in Utah, which is a $2 billion data center, which will use $40 million a year in electricity. And you think, okay, guys, why do you need that much storage? And, that data center will make possible the sorts of things that were alleged in the initial round of PRISM coverage. So is PRISM doing all of this evil stuff? Probably not. Is some other program? Almost certainly, right?
Yeah, well, this is exactly what the NSA is set up to do. It's their core business, as I think I said last week. Mm. And if they're not doing it now, they certainly want to be doing it. Mm. And whether or not this fallout impairs that at all, this remains to be seen. But I think the main thing I'm hanging out for is that Greenwald is saying he's got something like 1,000 more documents.
Yeah,
from
true.
Snowden. And he's got the next 6 months worth of headlines, kind of probably work in progress right now. So we're still only seeing a fraction of the picture, and things are probably going to change, and I imagine going to get much worse.
I just don't understand why Snowden leaked this stuff to a tit like Greenwald. That's all.
I think you're just jelly, aren't you?
I am a little bit jelly. I'm actually toad's jelly. There you go. Yeah, look, I mean, I have no doubt that if the NSA wanted to get into my Facebook account, what they would probably do is split off my connection somehow, pop up another connection. I mean, they've almost certainly got Facebook's SSL keys. They'd wait till I spool up a new connection. They'd have my session key. They'd pop up and, grab my creds, pop up a new connection coming from the same IP. They'd download all my crap. Facebook wouldn't know anything about it. I wouldn't know anything about it. I mean, why would we doubt that they would have that capability? I don't know, but PRISM isn't it. But you know what? For all the political fallout caused by the Snowden leaks, if we want to call them that, apparently half of people polled in the United States are actually, more than half actually, are totally cool with the NSA, spying on all their crap.
And this is that is just so depressing, really, isn't it? Apparently, 56% of Americans think it's fine for the NSA to track calls, millions of Americans, to investigate terrorism.
Yeah. Because there's been so many organized terrorist attacks in the United States lately.
Yeah, exactly. And the same survey asked people about intercepting emails, and 45% of people apparently think that's just fine too.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, really? Wake up, sheeple.
Oh, no, you didn't. Anyway, moving on to some other creepy government spying stuff, and Google says, it's uncovered some really bad stuff emanating out of Iran. It looks like the Iranian government has launched a massive domestic spying program targeting its own citizens in the lead up to that country's election.
Yeah, Google's saying that they've seen evidence of a phishing campaign, which is going to a Google phishing site to get people's Google credentials using certificates that are either legitimate or are generated using some technique. And the allegation Google's making is that it's the same people who hacked Genotar, the Dutch SSL CA. And I guess the implication is that the certs they're using have been signed by Genotar and are being used inside Iran for phishing. So Google is warning everybody in Iran to, be careful when accessing Google properties. Use Chrome, which will spot this kind of SSL certificate shenanigans through its cert pinning. But it's pretty concerning, I guess, when we're seeing, a government attacking its own citizens in this kind of way.
Yeah, look, it really is. And it's just, it's the next level up, isn't it, from the NSA thing?
Well, yeah, exactly. When you're going like full fishing an active man in the middle with faked up certs. Although I'm sure the NSA is perfectly capable and has done indeed exactly that. But it's not a good thing.
Now, staying with all things nation-state hacking and, you know, Iran and China and that whole thing, look, there's been another leak. I'm not sure if this one actually came from Snowden. If I had to put some money on it, if we remove Snowden from the equation, I'd say the US government probably leaked it themselves. But in the lead-up to the discussions Obama was having with Chinese authorities about, you know, cyber shenanigans between those two countries, the top secret executive order describing, you know, the cyber military policy, essentially, of the US government was leaked. And look, I mean, I had a look at it. It was pretty dull, to be honest. And there was nothing in there that was terribly surprising. I guess the aspect of it that people have latched onto is that Obama has asked, you know, the sort of military and intelligence apparatus to draft a list of possible targets for a cyber war, so they can just, you know, press the big red button when they're ready to go. That's kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting read, this particular document, and it codifies a few gaps I had about, you know, kind of exactly what they were, you know, how the thinking works inside the, you know, the US military. But the thing about, you know, picking targets and maintaining sort of standing capability to own them or maintain levels of access so that you're already there when you need it, we assume that that's what they were doing, but, you know, seeing it actually on paper is helpful, I guess.
Yeah, is it? I mean, I don't know, man. It seemed all very elementary. I mean, why the hell they're, you know, why are they classifying something like that to the level of TS Nofawn? I mean, what? It just, I mean, it was dull. It was like there was nothing new in that. There was nothing that we didn't know already. It seems like an example of overclassification to me.
Well, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. And if anything, it kind of demonstrated a fairly sort of mature way of thinking about it and thinking about the consequences and thinking about the, you know, chain of command and authorization and stuff. It actually looked relatively reasonable, which I guess is behind your theory of it actually being a deliberate leak.
Well, yeah, and I think it was useful for them to be able to point at something on the table when they had discussions with China and say, this is our policy, it's kind of reasonable. And they would have had to have leaked that in order to give the Chinese access to it. They can't give them access to classified documents. So,
no, especially when it's Nofawn, yeah.
As I say, I think the leak actually came from Obama's office itself. But, I mean, you know, something that should be labeled top secret, I would imagine, would be the target list, not a document that says, we have a target list, you know.
Well, because, like, duh, right?
Exactly. Anyway.
They're not going to fire them willy-nilly into cyberspace.
Now, you're going to love this. There's new legislation being introduced by the House Intelligence Committee, again, in the United States, which is going to target foreign hackers, which is, you know, a typical example of the US being creepy and trying to be world police. But, you know, one thing occurred to me, Adam.
What's that?
You're a foreign hacker.
Hmm.
Tell us about this bill.
Yeah, so they're proposing a bill that will allow them to go after hackers from, quote, offending nations and deliver, quote, real consequences and punishments, which I'm assuming to mean, like, you know, drone strikes on cyber cafes or something.
More like extradition requests, but
well, yeah, I'm looking out the window watching out for the, you know, the drones outside, but you know, I guess they feel like they have to do something about the incessantly being hacked by China and everyone else pretending to be China. But in the, you know, the context of the other news that's been breaking the last couple of weeks, it doesn't seem very well timed, does it?
Now, we've known for a long time that there's a security problem inherent in wireless devices, which is that they don't really do much to authenticate base stations, particularly, you know, insecure base stations, so you can do all funky stuff with Karma and whatnot. It turns out that iPhones are actually programmed with a directory of carrier-specific SSIDs, which means that you can actually Karma the crap out of them and man in the middle of them and do all sorts of awful stuff to them. This is not good.
Well, no. I mean, the first half of it is the fact that you can, you know, generate wireless networks that match names of networks that are being looked for by devices isn't new.
Yeah.
But I didn't know there was a hard-coded list of networks that operators ship with their phones, or indeed some of them apparently ship with stock iOS. And that really does give you some options because, you know, the out-of-the-box wireless client on iOS is actually much better about not falling for that sort of thing than it used to be, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, all you need to do is remove any unsecured Wi-Fi network from your auto join lists, basically on those sort of devices, and you're okay. But if there's something hard coded that isn't accessible through the menus, you're screwed.
Well, exactly, yeah, and for that reason, this is kind of a problem. You know, don't use wireless at all in public places, or indeed anywhere, perhaps.
Yeah, mostly I just don't use wireless when I go to KiwiCon and Rocks.
You know? Yeah, well, I mean, that is certainly, you know, robust and sound advice.
Now, going to some more traditional InfoSec news, and Google has actually upped its bug bounty program, which is kind of cool. So if you can find a cross-site scripting bug affecting Google accounts, you're up for $7,500. This is cool.
Yeah, good on them. them. You know, clearly their bug bounty program is working really well. They've given out, what, something like $800K
$828,000 to 250 people.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it's good, good cheap QA work. You know, it's good PR. You know, why wouldn't they do this? So, you know, good on them. And hopefully, we'll see some of the other vendors, you know, really take notice of how successful this has been for Google.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, the first couple of years of their program would have found the low hangers, and I guess the, you know, the additional money would reward the extra amount of work that it would require to find a decent bug in a Google service these days. Now, Microsoft has issued a tool to block, basically block Java out of IE. But it's a weird write-up, this one, because they're saying Microsoft has released a fix-it tool that does this. But really, what they're doing is they're blocking Java access through the browser. They're not allowing it to load.
Which it seems entirely sensible and probably should have happened already. You know, we've seen Click to Run in Chrome for ages. Firefox introduced it. Safari's going that way. You know, it makes sense that IE would now do the same thing. And, you know, hopefully it will, you know, move some of the, you know, the mass ownage we've seen of people running Java and IE off onto some other, you know, place we don't yet know about.
Java in your browser, not a good idea. We've kind of, I think we've done a reasonable job of that, of selling that message over the last year or so. Now, there's a really interesting little feature article on ThreatPost. I normally don't pull out features, but I thought this was a good one because, you know, we hear so much about sharing threat intelligence and, you know, indicators of compromise going everywhere, and it's all this wonderful, everyone's skipping through fields and stuff. This is an article that points out that no one's sharing shit because when you get owned, you know, your general counsel isn't going to allow you to share any meaningful sort of data. We've had a couple of people like Google, the New York Times have issued some indicators of compromise. You know, Mandiant sanitized the crap out of stuff and then issued just, you know, some very basic indicators of compromise. But this idea of a data sharing nirvana, it's not here. We're not there and we're not going to be there anytime soon. And I've got to say, I really agree with this article.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly, you know, our experience that this kind of data is pretty hard to come by. And when you're working with organizations that have been compromised, the last thing they want to do is share that and convince them that they, you know, that doing so is good for the ecosystem is, you know, it's a hard sell. You know, in certain industries, and like the way this particular article is talking about the financial services industry's information sharing thing, you know, where you're supposed to share indicators of compromise and other useful details, you know, in some certain areas that's working. But by and large, the only places that this is working is where it's done skunk works, you know, on the sly without telling, you know, the corporate general counsel. It's just the techies doing it, you know, quietly on a private mailing list.
Yeah, or on a silk server somewhere, you know.
Yeah, exactly, right, which is really not the way to try and build this. And we've seen some work towards, you know, standards for describing indicators of compromise and mechanisms for exchanging them in a useful way coming out of the out of MITRE, for example. And there's lots of really good work, but actually getting people to agree to share and to realize that, you know, we have to. Right, because of the asymmetry between attack and defense, we have to be able to share in order to have any hope in hell.
But it ain't gonna happen.
It's a really hard sell.
It ain't going to happen. I mean, I just don't see it happening anytime soon, at least.
Not on the kind of scale that has to happen to be useful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we need a major cultural shift, and we need to have executives on board, and they ain't there yet. They're still of the mentality of what? We don't want people knowing we got owned, you know? Sweep that shit under the carpet, Jesus.
Yeah, and I mean, and that really does need to change. And certainly, you know, Google coming out and saying it with Aurora helped, but we're a long way from where we need to be.
Yes, we are. All righty, well, we're just going to finish up this week's news with a bit of a bug roundup. We got some issues with BlackBerry, apparently, which is kind of rare.
Yeah, like all seven dudes who have BlackBerry playbooks need to patch them because who knew the version of Flash on the BlackBerry is actually just as bad as version of Flash everywhere else. So you should probably patch those, you know, if you or Dave or your buddy who's got one actually uses it.
We've also got a popular ICS, you know, industrial control system firmware, which contains, big surprise, drumroll please, a hard-coded FTP credential. I mean, this is the only reason I put this one in this week's show is because, you know, we had a bit of a chuckle about something similar last week, like, oh my God, stop presses.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure, you know, user or admin admin or whatever the hell it was. Yeah, like I'm shocked and horrified that that still happens.
The thing that I find funny about this is like it was IO Active guys who found this or gals and, you know, they told ThreatPost all about it and wouldn't actually name the device. So I'm kind of curious as to how they justified giving that story ink. But anyway, now, awful enterprise crapware, you know, Tivoli, etc. We all know it's ownable. There's a cert has actually warned of a bunch of vulnerabilities in HP. Insight Diagnostics, which is some of that awful enterprise software that gets you owned.
Yeah, Insight Diagnostics is interesting because it generally actually runs out on the individual servers rather than on a big centralized thing. You're quite likely to run across it. It's quite likely to have never been patched ever. And I imagine quite a lot of internal enterprise networks will get owned with these bugs. Although, let's face it, they're already owned anyway, so no real delta there. But yes, don't run enterprise HP crapware.
Yeah, look, I'd be very surprised if a lot of more advanced attackers weren't using these sorts of bugs to do their lateral movement because,
Well, I know I do.
Yeah, well, there you go, right? Now, look, before we go, that's actually it for the bug roundup, but you pointed me towards a very interesting piece that I tweeted. Now, this really ties back, as I said earlier, the Prism thing, I think, has really distracted the media from the, awful intrusion that is the hoovering up of, phone metadata based on, domestic calls that originated from within and terminated within the United States. That stuff is horrible. And this is a really good description of why it's horrible. It's a blog post written as if it was 1772, which just looks at using traffic analysis and metadata to find Paul Revere, who was an American revolutionary and a patriot of the
terrorist.
American Revolution.
Terrorist.
Well, of course, he would have been seen as a terrorist back then, which is the point. So it's a fascinating write-up of how they could have actually used metadata analysis to find and execute this revolutionary.
Yeah, it's a great example of the sorts of analysis, fairly basic analysis you can do on networks of people and their their memberships to organizations or groups or whatever. It's a great worked example of the power of metadata.
So I would really recommend that people go check out this week's show notes and pull up that story. It's a fascinating read and really demonstrates the power of metadata analysis and traffic analysis. But Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure we're going to chat again next week.
Yeah, hopefully, as long as I am not hit by a drone strike.
Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him, and big thanks also to our hosting provider in Sydney, Virtual Office. That is OFFIS. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Richard Thieme. He's spoken at, I think, 16 DEF CON conferences on security and intelligence. He's written a bunch of books, and he's also a good friend of mine. Richard has had a fascinating life and has some pretty diverse interests. He was an Episcopal priest for 16 years before he threw that in and became a full-time author and speaker. His latest book is called UFOs in Government, but he's probably better known for his compiled works, Islands in the Clickstream. He's an extremely intelligent guy, very out-of-the-box thinker, and I've had some absolutely fascinating conversations with Richard over the years. Now, Richard is a baby boomer, and I just make the cut as a Generation Xer. And you know what? It occurred to me when I saw this Eric Snowden guy's interview on the Guardian website that he's the archetype, an archetype of a different generation. Now, the guy's only 6 years younger than me, but that puts him squarely into Gen Y territory. And it is a generalization, but some cultural values the Gen Ys and millennials seem to hold dear revolve a lot around online liberty, privacy, and a really deep suspicion of authority. If you saw the interview with Snowden on the Guardian website, you would have heard him voicing concerns that really obviously spring from those core ideals. Now, whether or not these ideals are actually emblematic of a genuine counterculture, or if it's just, the way that people who grew up with the internet tend to think about these things, either way, it's an interesting phenomenon. And I guess what makes it particularly interesting these days is, unlike the countercultural movement of the 60s or the counterculturals of the 60s, today's counterculture internet generation guys and gals aren't on the outside looking in. Thanks to the digital revolution, it's young, technologically capable people like Snowden who run the information systems that power our institutions. And that puts us in an interesting position. The counterculture has entered the building. Could this mean that we're on the cusp of a radical reshape of institutional culture? Are we about to see hundreds of Snowdens leaking more of this sort of material and actively undermining the establishment from the inside out? Well, I chatted with Richard Thieme via Skype to see what he thought. And I started off by asking him to define, in a broad sense, what he thinks these core ideals of the internet generation seem to be.
It's difficult to generalize extremely and precisely, because the generalizations, always go over the edge. You color over the line. But let me give it a very broad shot. The way it looks to me is that a generation has grown up with the technology, and an awful lot of the values that we like to associate with the counterculture or non are very much a part of that technology and that use of technology, I should say, but it's full of contradictions. On the one hand, they totally expect their lives to be open and transparent. They understand that they are putting an incredible amount of detail about themselves on the web, through social media, through the way they share data, and there's very, very little hidden. On the other hand, and this is the contradictory part, there's a strong hunger to be free from oppressive intrusion and surveillance. In other words, they don't mind using the internet to the fullest extent, which may make people at Facebook chuckle at how they give away so much of themselves and then let it be turned into a product. But what they really don't want is for that openness to be abused. And the event that just took place, it sounds abusive. It sounds like an intrusion and a misuse of data by the National Security Agency. Now, what's most significant about this for the generation, as I look at it, is for me, this is old news. I mean, I was part of a group, mostly NSA, but some other people who for over a period of about 10 years after 9/11, because this shift had taken place in the intelligence community, were concerned with the ethics of what it meant to engage in this level of intrusion. And realistically, I had predicted this back in the 90s by simply following the technology. And by that, I mean, you knew that you couldn't determine where something originated or where it was going to wind up by where it transited. And the fact that things go through the United States didn't mean they came from here, and it didn't mean they were headed here. So following the technology meant that the boundaries around countries, around nation states, were now semi-permeable in a way that made 20th century understanding of the law, our Constitution in the United States, and in the urgency of the time after the 9/11 attack, which was really traumatic for America, it meant that you had to follow the technology and do whatever you could do with it to prevent attacks. At least that's how it was understood.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that these two sorts of things happened at the same time. I mean, you had the 9/11 attacks, which made governments go on this berserker, you know, national security thing, at the same time that the internet was really taking off as a mainstream technology and as a mainstream communication technology. So the emergence of this sort of digital generation and the emergence of a security-oriented state happened at the same time, which is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Well, you're right, although you're absolutely right. But where I sit, it looks like the national security state, which is post-World War II, was accelerated by the Internet revolution. And I had been tracking that since the 1980s. I once asked the lead historian at the National Security Agency, what can you and I discuss with some reasonable certainty that by the words we use about historical events, we mean the same things? And he said, only half tongue-in-cheek, anything up until 1945, by which he meant black projects, disinformation, misinformation, compartmentalization, and the radical acceleration of the national security state really has been the condition of life from the 1950s on. But the digitalization of our lives to the degree that it has happened really, really accelerated that.
And well, it's almost like we only had a bit of a brief pause during the Clinton years because, you know, we had all Reaganomics and, you know, epic armament during the Cold War. Then we had George Bush, who was your president, George Bush Sr., who used to actually run the CIA. And then you had Clinton come in and everything sort of seemed to stay quite static for a while. And then all of a sudden, September 11 happens and off we go again.
Well, I can't speak to whether things were static under Clinton. I do know that the things that you're attributing to Bush, my comment on that is that Obama is more Bush than Bush.
Yeah.
Obama has punished leaks and leakers more severely than Bush ever did. Obama has accelerated the use of these technologies, and he has repeated the mantra, just trust me. But what we're talking about is I had described to me the scene in the director's office at the NSA after 9/11 when he was communicating the executive orders that came from the Bush White House and said, this is what we're going to do. And I was told the silence in that office was so thick that you could cut it because that had been something that these senior professional men and women – had always been told we never do. And that was because it violated the Constitution. We did not surveil Americans. Now, as you know, lawyers can parse any reality and make it sound like something else. And they did in this case by saying, in effect, for years now, we are going to gather up, vacuum up everything we can. They've had to accelerate the most sophisticated technologies in order to do this and keep up. And it's a race that may not be won, but we're going to do everything we can to gather everything. But then by couching it as metadata parsing, rather than we're not listening to the calls, they say literally that it's kind of like quantum physics. You know, the particle doesn't know through what slit to go until somebody looks at it. Well, they're saying the information isn't surveilled until someone analyzes it. Therefore, to gather it and store it is irrelevant. But they're missing the whole point. What we have here is not a panopticon, but a panspectron. And what a panspectron is a society in which every bit of information, which is increasingly digital, about your life, is gathered and databased. And then the power is not in the observation of you. It's in the click that aggregates, synthesizes that data in seconds and makes everything visible and available. And, of course, the great downside of that is that that power can be abused. Mm. So part of what interests me about this particular event with Snowden is that that people are acting as if these things on the nightly news are a surprise.
Mm.
And another factor that this young man represents is the acceleration or the explosion of people as contractors who then are granted all sorts of clearances. And you have to conclude that these political issues you're raising, which are really libertarian issues. You're talking about a libertarian strain, a strong libertarian strain.
Well, hang on. I just want to cut in there because, you know, what we've spoken about thus far is really talking about how we got here in terms of, you know, a national security obsessed, you know, borderline surveillance state. I mean, we kind of agree that that's where we are. Now, at the same time, you know, let's look back over the Gen Ys and the millennials, their experience. I mean, I was the last of the generation here in Australia that didn't have internet access at high school. You know, we just didn't have it. Whereas that is a completely, you know, that's a crazy idea to anyone, even a couple of years younger than me. I'm the last of Generation X, right? So we're talking about Gen Ys and millennials who have a completely different relationship to technology. Now, you spoke before about the inherent contradiction, which is they're throwing so much stuff out there, which looks funny to people of older generations. But to them, they're saying, look, we understand what is private and what is not. We understand how much can be inferred, although probably some of them don't. A lot of them would say, we understand what can be inferred from all of this data we make public. But then again, there are certain communications that we have online that we would like to regard as private. And that is absolutely sacrosanct. I mean, that seems to be the general ethos of these guys, right?
That's right. But let me tell you what they don't understand, because they're young. They don't understand the nature of real evil. And they don't understand what venal-driven people will do to someone in the interest of dominating or rendering them harmless. They don't understand that gunshots do ring out in Dealey Plaza and people die from it. In other words, they have a strong libertarian streak, and there's a lot of support for that right now in the United States. But they're also they're naive. What I've heard from Snowden is naive, and you know, a lot of us seem to agree that he exaggerates the access he had and his own importance.
Well, and he seems to be exaggerating the impact of the PRISM program as well. I mean, the Verizon stuff is terrifying, but PRISM seems it's a $20 million a year program. To put that into perspective, the NSA is building a $2 billion data center in Utah that's going to use double that $20 million, $40 million a year just in electricity. I mean, that kind of tells us that PRISM...
I know. My understanding is that was one reason for building that in Utah is because Maryland couldn't give them the juice they needed to run it. That might be a joke, but there are political reasons as well.
Maybe they just thought Mitt Romney was going to get elected, right? So they wanted to butter him up.
Yeah, right. No, I once did a talk at DEF CON, and it was some time ago, called Hacker Generations, and it was identifying the three generations in the 10 years I had been at DEF CON to that point. In other words, every two or three years, I could distinguish a different generation. When you define a generation as the behaviors it has internalized as possible, as well as optimal, based on how the technologies with which it grew up socialized them. And that's the assumption when you say the internet. What I'm finding is that young people don't talk about going on the internet. That's how fast. It's as obsolete as when my mother said, "I'm on long distance, be quiet." We're talking over Skype. We don't think of this as long distance. We think of this as just calling or talking to each other. Well, with the internet permeating so many aspects of life and the Internet of Things on its way and miniaturization of computers and embedded sensors and chips in damn near everything coming, including in ourselves, the phrase, "I'm going to go on the internet," will be as obsolete as "I'm going to go on the power grid now and then flip a switch and the lights come on and everybody goes ooh and ah."
Now look, I just want to drag this back to the issue at hand, which is Eric Snowden and this particular leak.
Okay.
I mean, let's just have a look at this counterculture as being a unique one. Because, you know, the internet culture that we're discussing, I mean, I keep referring to it as a counterculture, but I kind of feel like these guys are different. This generation is different. And because they've grown up with the internet, these are sort of prevailing views. In other words, it might not necessarily be a counterculture for much longer. It might be the dominant culture. Now, normally it takes a while for a counterculture, for values of a counterculture to be absorbed by broader society. We saw elements of the 60s counterculture eventually permeate through wider society. But I'd argue that this counterculture's adoption into the mainstream and adoption by the establishment is going to be greatly accelerated simply because we live in a digital world these days, and the people who are running our institutions, the people who have access to all of our information and all of our secrets, are these young internet generation people. So Snowden, to me, is the archetype of this generation. He sounds like a Redditor. He sounds almost a bit like an Anon, a little bit like an online activist and a pro WikiLeaks guy. He's talking about going to Iceland because it was, you know, kind of looking after WikiLeaks. So do you think, to what degree is this a unique situation? To what degree do the skills of this generation and their ability to actually run our institutions, you know, to what degree do you think that means their influence over our establishment institutions will be accelerated?
Okay, that's a good question. And there's a yes and no answer to it. For one thing, they're not running things. One of the things the digital revolution has done is shift the use of power. And I used to say this years ago, that instead of dominating and controlling, when you function in a network, the way you exercise power is to participate and contribute. And you're a node in the network, and power is exercised differently as a node in the network. But think of it as like a tree with wide branches. The power is horizontal, but the trees are taller. And yes, he had power as a node in the network to exploit the opportunity he had to address what he thought was a societal grievance that should be exposed. But he did it in the context of a hierarchy that is going to come down on him like a hammer. The question, and I think it's a serious question, look at what's going on in Turkey right now. Turkey is a democracy. A guy went too far, and suddenly they're in the streets. And this radicalizes the population that was peacefully protesting and can radicalize an entire generation. The way the 1968 convention, with the beating, the police riot that took place there and the wholesale beating of protesters, radicalized the generation and was a very important factor in tilting people toward wanting the Vietnam War, which became more and more and more unpopular and unwinnable, obviously. We wanted it to end. Well, it's not the Vietnam War that people want to end, but it's whether or not enough of these kinds of events, like the Snowden event, let's call it that, will catalyze a crystallization in a larger part of the societal mind that is outraged by what is taking place. We're doing a lot of remembering of Selma, Alabama right now, because the water hoses on children and the dogs on children kind of convicted the conscience of a nation to suddenly say, what the hell? A black person can't drink water at a water fountain, get a hotel room, sit in a restaurant? What the hell? It's that kind of what the hell event that people like Snowden in their iterational function can precipitate. In other words, if enough people iterating Snowden-like events and embodying the values you're articulating continue to do this, if they really expose grievous intrusion and misuse of surveillance, which is going to be the critical thing, the misuse of it, because people will give the government the ability to do this if they really believe it's fighting terrorism, stopping things, and all the government can say is, we wish we could tell you what this is about. We wish you could tell you the things we've stopped by doing this. Well, that's another version of trust me. And if there is a case of an egregious abuse of the power that they have by vacuuming up all the communications of Americans to one another, and I happen to think it's only a matter of time before some egregious abuse not takes place, but becomes public, because abuse is always taking place, then that could crystallize events in a larger strain of society, as I say, the societal mind, and things could suddenly tilt. It could mean more it wouldn't be the radicalization of the American society, it would be the libertarianization of the society, which is a strain that's always been there, but not quite like this. People need first to become aware and awake of what, in fact, these technologies have enabled people with power, both corporate and government, to actually do. And it's the naivete that would be broken. But
to a degree, I mean, what you're saying is that things haven't really changed that much. And what we need, I guess what you're saying is what we would need if these sorts of changes were to occur. I shouldn't say what we need, because that would be putting a value judgment on it. But in order for, you know, a big change to occur, it won't necessarily just be these people working in their regular jobs within these institutions. In order for the institutional culture to change, there needs to be a string of these sorts of events. There needs to be martyrs. There need to be people being locked up and people saying, this is wrong, because what they're trying to do is help us. So for everything that's changed, things haven't really changed, I guess, is what you're getting at, right?
Things, if by things we mean the big picture and the way society operates, no, they have not changed. And the other part of that is there is a strong conservative strain that looks at, for example, the Arab Spring. It's not the first time a revolution promised one thing, but the people who saw their opportunity exercised power from Lenin on to get a hold of the revolution and do something completely other than what it promised. So one of the reasons responsible conservatives become responsible conservatives is they don't think a revolution of any kind is ever going to result in the fundamental overhaul of human nature. And to date, the reason America has pretty much more or less worked is because of checks and balances. And the checks and balances were instituted because the founding fathers and mothers knew what human beings are like and what we will do if given the opportunity and in an unrestricted environment. And so the checks and balances are meant to curtail the evil that men do on behalf of the general good. And if those fail, as in Turkey, it looks like some segment of the population thinks they are failing, then you can go into the streets. But as you see in Tunisia and Algeria and Libya and on in Egypt, what is going to replace it?
Turkey is a vastly different example, because the protesters in the streets are actually protesting against a democratically elected Islamic government. I mean, most Turks are actually fiercely secular, so it's a complete reverse example of the sort of things that we've seen in Egypt. But
yes, but what's happening in America is we have an absolutely democratically elected government, and I know a lot of people who feel helpless. You see, that's the one piece of this that it's hard to understand when you're not here. When I'm giving talks about these kinds of things in my professional life, often a hand will go up and somebody will say, stop, I don't want to know that. And they don't want to know it because it frightens them, it makes them anxious, and they feel helpless in the face of it. In fact, one guy in a workshop said, you're making me feel helpless, stop it. And I said, that's great, because you were helpless when you came in, but you didn't know it. Now you know it, You want to go up one more notch to taking personal responsibility for doing something about it.
So we've been talking about, the likelihood that this generation's, we've got this sort of counterculture embedded and fused with establishment institutions. And, this isn't likely to change things quickly yet. But it would seem that the, the internet generation, which I guess is aged up to about 30 now, gradually, every generation winds up eventually inheriting these institutions from the generation that came before. So the X's are in the process of inheriting institutions from baby boomers at the moment, for example. I mean, it's essentially going from your generation to my generation at this point. Do you think that these internet sort of freedom ideals will survive long enough for the people who currently ascribe to those ideals to still hold them dear by the time they reach positions of authority? Or do you think the prevailing institutional culture will sort of belt those ideals out of them by the time they get there?
History seems to suggest that the higher up you go in any organizational structure, whether government or corporation or nonprofit, doesn't matter what, the more assimilated you become, body and soul, spirit and psyche, to the values and operational behaviors of that culture. The way Timothy Leary said it was, you never get the truth from a company memo because the Borg will absorb you. And the current scandal with the Roman Catholic Church worldwide is a terrific example. The only way to advance to power in the Roman Catholic Church was to preserve and protect the criminal culture that had become pervasive in the pedophile and financial corruption of that institution.
So you got to be, you either get on the bus or you don't get on the bus, I guess is what you're saying, right?
Well, that's right. And it's very difficult because in the Roman Catholic Church, there's only one way to vote, which is walk. Don't give money, don't go.
But I guess it's the same at the NSA, right?
Yes, yes and no. You can't, I don't think people appreciate the power over your life that signing that oath has. Let me give you an example. I was once one of the guardians of an archive at the Hoover Institution of War, Revolution and Peace at Stanford University. And into the archive went depositions from people who were concerned about what they considered egregious ethical issues that arose in various kinds of intelligence work. Now, in that group that I mentioned before, where we worked on intelligence and ethics for a number of years to try to influence the thinking inside the agency about it. So I was telling some of the people involved in that ethics and intelligence initiative about the archive and suggesting that if they had serious concerns, they could sign depositions because the Hoover Institute guaranteed security. And they all burst out laughing because they knew and said, there's nothing we can't get if we want it. That's number one. And then someone said, you need to understand that the oaths we sign have teeth, and that if you violate the oath, you sacrifice your financial well-being, you sacrifice your pension, and you may go to jail. In other words, you sacrifice a lot. Now, a difference between this young man and the senior people I know at the agency, this is what they kind of uniformly are saying. They say, whether you want to give it credibility or not, look, there are numerous opportunities to raise your concerns about what we're doing inside the agency. And there are steps you can take that go all the way up to and including engaging the inspector general in the process of examining some behavior or process that you're concerned is a violation of something fundamental. In other words, they think that somebody like Snowden jumped through a thousand steps to whistleblowing without a real understanding of what he was blowing the whistle on, seriously what damage he was doing to the other side of it, which is counterterror, although I'm not sure how much damage that really was. But by the time they reach these senior positions and they're over 50 and they have families, Snowden didn't have a family. He ditched his girlfriend in Hawaii and took off.
The pole dancing acrobat.
Well, that's... Isn't that your idea of an ideal spouse, Patrick?
Well, I think living in Hawaii with a pole dancing acrobat,
Well, pole dancing is done. It's for everybody now at the local gym, right? But at any rate, I'm saying the culture continues to exist as it was. I know a number of people who have grievances with what they think took place, and they are afraid of saying so aloud. I don't think people understand the potency of the threat of a hand around your throat. And one of the things the Obama administration has been doing is saying the hammer is going to come down on you like it's never come down before. That's the interesting thing with this so-called liberal. Hackers are being sentenced. You know that story. Hackers are getting prison sentences. But the bankers who brought the society almost to ruin, not one is in jail.
Well, Richard, all terribly interesting stuff. I could speak about this with you all day, but unfortunately we're out of time. I really appreciate you making the time to actually have a chat to us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Patrick. It's always great to talk to you, and you're doing a terrific job.
Richard Thieme there. Next up, it is time for this week's sponsor interview, and this week's show is brought to you by Solera Networks, which is now a blue coat company. And joining us by phone is Solera Vice President of Product Strategy, John Vecchi. I wanted to ask John if he thought all the focus on APT detection lately means we might be missing other types of intrusion techniques. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think it is. I think it is absolutely plausible. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we hear the term advanced persistent threat a lot. But I'm not like many others, I don't necessarily like that term in many cases, because it doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of these threats can be terribly advanced. They can be pretty basic, right? Oftentimes it might be the techniques that they're using, the vectors they're using, maybe combining it with social engineering or some form. And so if you take your eye off kind of the mundane, you may open yourself up to what we might still be defined as an advanced persistent threat, because some of the threats aren't necessarily so advanced. They can be very targeted, however. And so I think, at the end of the day, we want to look at this holistically. I think in some cases we want to try to make the tools we have already a little bit more context aware and make those a little bit better. I think it needs to be viewed very holistically. I think it's a very valid point. Let's be very careful as we get distracted of these big, big, bad attacks. Let's make sure we're not taking our eye off the ball, because sometimes it could be a small attack that might be the one that grows into something much bigger, right?
Well, I guess the reason I ask about this is because the tradecraft, the current vector du jour for these APT actors tends to be a spear phishing-based email, either with just, with a dodgy PowerPoint or, PDF or whatever, and they tend to escalate. They'll use like an old bug. Well, I just try to get people to install their badware for them. If that doesn't work, they might go to a Java one day or something like that. But always the initial point of infection is to infect a host on the network. It's to infect a workstation. And I kind of wonder if this means people are so focused with looking for APT style connect backs and funny little HTTP aware, interactive shells and stuff like that. That's where we're winning is in finding that sort of stuff. I worry that they're not all of a sudden looking at their load balancer, which is, which is on some publicly addressable space and not firewalled. And, they're not watching for people using other vectors to attack us. Do you think that to a degree, we're too focused on actually looking at those basic APT infection vectors?
I think it can be, yeah. I think in many cases that can happen. I mean, and oftentimes I think, as you mentioned, taking a look at the load balancers, taking a look at other indicators of compromise that at first glance might not necessarily lead you to think this is some kind of known attack or some kind of attack, but at the end of the day may very well be something you want to watch. And this is why I think, more as we harness more data, as we take that to pull out metadata attributes, other indicators of compromise that might otherwise, be missed, those are things we need to take into account today in this landscape. And it may very well be what's happening with other areas of my network, what's happening with load balancers, what's happening with other infrastructure areas and other pieces of my network that might actually indicate something. And so, we like to talk about the idea of harnessing the data and leveraging, you know, the data in your network to tell us something. And in many cases, we may need to pull a variety of pieces together like a puzzle to actually say, when I look at this alone, it might not tell me much. When I look at this plus that plus this and I get the context of it, now it might form a picture of something that I might want to look at.
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because the key word you mentioned there was context. And
yep.
I guess that's the thing. I mean, at the moment, a lot of the gear, like, you know, your gear, RSA NetWitness, I mean, it's at the moment, it's looking for something pretty specific, and it might not necessarily catch real crazy stuff that, you know, that isn't very common at the moment. But this reminds me, and I'm going to be a terrible name dropper here, John, but I had a chat with Vint Cerf many years ago about this whole concept of Oprah's book club syndrome when it comes to information being available on the internet, which is because people tend to research these days just what's available on the internet, there's a whole lot of information that they might be missing that might not yet be indexed and, you know, actually available online. And Vint Cerf said to me, well, you know, surely the solution to that isn't to not use the internet. Surely the solution to that is to put more information onto the internet so that you're not losing that context. I guess what you're saying is that in the case of trying to detect things that aren't, you know, typical APT tradecraft, when you're just looking for anomalies, context is everything. And the solution is to bring more data into these big data security products, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we need the data so that we can inspect it. We can pull out, we can index it. We can pull out the attributes. You know, it's not decreasing. It's only increasing every day. And as, you know, we look at more and more applications and the way that the web is being used, that data is only going to explode. And so, you know, this is a tough thing. We need more data, to provide more context, provide more security visibility, into what's happening. And so the difficulty though, is assuring that you can perform at that kind of speed, at you know, maybe you're pulling data on a 10 gigabit link, and that's an awful lot of data, and you're in real time, you're capturing that data, you're indexing it, you're pulling out the metadata attributes, you're warehousing it, you're extracting files and reconstructing them. There's a lot that's happening. The important thing is we need to keep pace with it, but at the end of the day, what customers want is, look, do what you're supposed to do and provide the context and give me visual insight into what's happening. And for those of us who are providing those solutions, you know, we need to keep pace. We need to be able to do that at very high rates and with a heck of a lot of data. Mm-hmm. And given that we're looking at, you know, not only the packets, but the flows and the files and the applications, it stacks up pretty quickly, right?
It does. And I guess, you know, one of the problems that I see with automated, stuff, post-compromised detection equipment, you know, yours included, has proved to be very effective and something that I think has been needed in the sort of mix of vendor solutions for quite a long time. I think there's been too much of a focus on trying to prevent stuff from happening, which you can't prevent. That's why IDS kind of tanked as a market, 10 years ago, is because all these CIOs were like, why the hell would we want it unless it tells us, unless it stops stuff from happening. But I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, aren't we back to that perennial security problem with any type of automated analysis where it's good at picking known tradecraft, it's good at picking known attacks, but if someone's using some sort of novel technique to actually, first of all, establish some sort of connection into a network, and then using some pretty novel stealthy stuff in the back end, I mean, unless this is a known attack type, it's kind of difficult to spot, isn't it, with automated analysis? I mean, automated analysis can be good for picking sort of funny outliers, and, you know, you guys can actually spin up VMs and spot stuff, you know, automatically, and spot stuff that's changing registry values and stuff, so you can kind of find a lot of O-Day stuff that way. But when you're talking about a wily attacker, do you think people are relying on this equipment too much to spot everything and to give them, they're assuming 100% visibility?
Yeah. Well, it's easy to do, and I think it is happening. What we want to try to automate, so the answer is definitely yes. And I think you there's a reliance to say, just automate it, make it easy for me to see it. But as you mentioned, with the kind of techniques we're seeing, the types of unknown novel malware coming their way that's coupled with, you know, advanced techniques and actors behind them that are very motivated and oftentimes have a lot of resources at their disposal, it's really hard to do. When we say, when we think in terms of automation, at least from, you know, a security intelligence analytics and advanced threat protection perspective, we're trying to just say, look, what we want to do is capture the data, provide the visibility, do analytics on that, bring in threat intelligence that's very, very critical. That'll help us try to make a determination whether we know this is good or bad or not, or whether we need to do more analysis on this or put it on a watch list and come back and check it later. But the automation that, that we want is more not so much about triggering it on something that might be known, but taking all these relationships, doing analytics on them, and trying to make it simple for them to at least to tell them what to look at and what to look for from the perspective of what a solution like ours is doing for them. And so, you know, they might say, look, if you're digesting all this data, you're indexing, you're pulling out metadata attributes, you're categorizing it, and you're doing all this stuff, and you're checking against, you know, maybe URL and IP categorization and reputation, you're taking a hash from the file, and you're doing a reputation on that. You might even be detonating it in a sandbox and providing back the result of that. But when you do all those things together, can you give me some visual representation of what you found that might tell me, hey, after all of this, this right here is something, and all this massive data and everything happening in your network, right here is something you need to take a look at right now. And, you know, because this isn't necessarily real time, it's more near real time, we're doing this and saying, look, this may already be present in your network, but we're telling you, you need to look at this because this plus this plus this is bad, or we've actually, through our intelligence, have identified this as bad and it's in your network and here's how it got in, here's why it got in, now you need to go take action on that. And I think that's maybe the model that we need to at least not necessarily completely shift to, but bring into the model we have now, which is just tell me right now, automate it and just tell me, you know, more of that kind of preventative-based approach. And this is going to be more prevention coupled with preparedness and visibility to deal with the reality that, you know, this stuff's going to get in, but we want to make sure we identify it quick and not, you know, 6 months from now, right?
So I guess it's a little bit in column A and a little bit in column B. John Vecchi, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for chatting to us on Risky Business.
Thanks so much.
Baby, I'm living in a crazy place, and I'm not dying.
John Vecchi of Solera Networks there. Big thanks to Solera Networks for its support of the Risky Business podcast. And congratulations to all on the big blue coat acquisition, guys. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is a new one by my buddy, Marshall O'Kell. It's from his new album, Birdie, which you can find on iTunes, and it's almost, this track, almost a little bit country. I really like it. Marshall is down playing for a few weeks around Ginderbine, so if you're heading that way for a skiing weekend or something, make sure you check him out and tell him I said hi. This one's called Right Here in Front of Me. Get it on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I've got what I want. It's right here in front of me. Now, baby, I'm singing my heart out for you. I'm not bitching about a friend I know. When I'm watching the surf and I'm dreaming, I'm not blinded by that mofo holding glare. And I've got what I want. It's right here in front of me. And I've got what I want. It's right here.
I've got what I want.